I'll do what I can to get us to lunch as quickly as possible. I can do that by just asking a question. Does everybody, in fact, know you can take an awake rat and put it in a magnet and generate a high-quality image? The answer is yes, we're done. I'm hoping the answer is no, or at least, you know, there's maybe some questions to come from that. But what we tried to do this morning is put together what I would consider to be, you know, new technologies, some newer than others, as part of a drug development toolbox, if you will. And what I want to do is add to that and tell you about the work that we do that's been pioneered here and in large part by Craig Ferris over the years in awake animal imaging. I'll start just by reminding everybody this was a survey generated from attendees at the Translational CNS Summit earlier this year here. And if you can see on this slide, the majority of people considered the main reason or involved in the reason for failure of a clinical trial of a CNS drug had to do with, and I can't read this that well here, had to do with the failure of animal models to be predictive of a clinical outcome. So we're back to what I think Mike described as, you know, a phrase very easily used and often used, but not often borne out, and that is translational medicine or research. As a preclinical scientist, and I think most of us may be, we're always interested or focused on generating data in the laboratory for use down the road, ultimately in the clinic. I think what, you know, needs to be focused, and I think has been focused in later years, is the reverse translation and use of information generated in people and brought back into the laboratory. And it's the development of these new tools and their applications that then can be applied more useful or and be more predictive in benefiting the development of better and newer therapies. So the translational forces, I think, that are behind a lot of what we see in industry is that obviously, again, anybody in pharma or biotech doesn't have to be told they're under a great deal of pressure. And that imaging and, in particular, biomarkers are being used more and more in clinical trials in the hope of getting an early idea of efficacy and safety. Ultimately, the goal is to not only to identify winners but losers as early in development as possible. So the mandate, again, I don't need to tell you, is to find the most insightful, cost-effective, and means of generating preclinical data, and very importantly, that translate or minimizes the risk in clinical development. And imaging, and this is just not my words, is the language of translation. So ultimately, preclinical imaging that's performed in a way that best mirrors what's done clinically, and that's underlined for a reason, will provide unprecedented value and enhance the drug development process. So, academia and universities, I think, have done a very good job in doing what they do. And if you want to find a luminary or a key opinion leader, more often than not, you're going to find them on the campus of the major university. Universities, you know, are for the most part, in comparison to other parts of our industry, high tech. But there's certainly, if not a lack of control, a perceived lack in control. And then when I mean lack in control, that means contracting work to them as a pharmaceutical or a biotech company. There is a part-time dedication, again, an academician or a professor has multiple things going on in his lab and is not focused on only one your one project. Legal challenges, tech transfers, anybody that's worked with universities, I don't have to tell you what the hurdles are there. Again, universities are focused more on basic research and their deliverables, if you will. The end goal is publications. Now, if you took a look at the vendor or the contract research side and its evolution over the years, you know that CROs are, for the most part, focused on what I would call applied research, or research geared towards drug development. They're known for their infrastructure, in large part because it's very much a regulatory-driven business or process. They're service-oriented. Some professors are service-oriented. And they're more, you hear a lot about risk-sharing models now, but for the most part, CROs operate under a fee-for-service basis. They're less high-tech, more often than not. And as far as a deliverable, the final product that a CRO offers is a report. Now, if you were able to combine the two, at least again in my opinion, you'd end up with what could be an ideal solution to what is often the in need of as far as an industry. So I'll tell you very quickly just in terms of what ECIM is and what it is. We're an imaging, preclinical imaging CRO that combines the best of those worlds, and just we happen to be based right here at Northeastern University. We're a spin-out of the center that's directed by Craig Ferris. The CT and I are the Center for Translational Neuroimaging, founded by the guy that really has pioneered the field of awake animal imaging. Again, that being Craig, who's been doing this for 20-plus years now. ECAM is very much a technology-driven CRO that is enabled by exclusive technology, MSAs with the university, our IP and important know-how. Our focus is really on high-field MRI, and again, it's awake animals. It doesn't have to be an awake animal, but our point of differentiation is doing awake animals. We do work in mice, voles, and until just recently, I had no idea what a vole is, but that's subject for a whole nother conversation. But we're doing a lot of work in voles, rats, and we've done work and can do work in marmoset monkeys. Importantly, too, an image is only as good as the analysis you can do. And it's through the advanced data analysis with proprietary 3D atlases that we have in these different species that allows us to do what we do. And this is a quote from Greenberg back from 2008. Brain activity during wakefulness cannot be inferred using anesthesia. Somewhat intuitive, I think. Anybody that's had an MR or knows someone that's had an MR realizes that it's typically done to get a very high-resolution anatomical scan. But what we do is more imaging of function and activity. And this cartoon, if you will, provides an idea for the kind of detail or information when it's relating to activity, integrated neural networks and circuits and so on. Just very quickly, the basis for what we do and the type of imaging we do, I think Kevin alluded to the fact that what we use is BOLD imaging, which stands for blood oxygen level dependent changes, which is, I just simply put, a change in microvasculature, the change in blood flow in response to a neuron being activated and becoming more metabolically active. The opposite can be true. You can look at deactivation also. Do you need to image animals fully awake in all therapeutic areas? Of course not. And in fact, I'd maintain the real value add in imaging an awake animal has to do on the CNS side. We do, so our focus is on psychiatric and cognitive illnesses that are listed here, certainly neurodegeneration, and applying the work or applying the animal models now available through SAGE has been a focus of the work. And you mentioned pain. We do a lot of work in pain, and again, evaluating or studying the changes in brain activity and what's happening within the brain and the circuits in an awake animal is much more informative than doing so in an anesthetized animal. And I think Lena will talk a great deal about that later this afternoon. And TBI, I won't steal any of Craig's thunder. He'll talk about the work done in TBI. So no, we don't. You don't need to do work in awake animals in a lot of other areas. You can image a tumor, you can image a joint. The animals don't need to be necessarily awake. I've highlighted and underlined CNS safety because I'm of the opinion that this is still very fertile ground for imaging, and in particular awake animals. We've done preliminary work fingerprinting drugs at risk for suicidal ideation. I think we've only just begun to scratch the surface, you know, in terms of the potential of what we could do in an awake animal using high-field MRI. This is not high-throughput screening like Alice does, but this is just meant to show, set up the technology that's used. We can set up an animal. First, the animal is lightly anesthetized using ISO, and by the time the animal goes into its head coil and restrainer, it's fully awake, which takes about 2 to 3 minutes. So within five minutes, we can have an animal set up into the bore of the magnet and ready to be imaged. Again, you'll see a little or hear a little bit about this more later, but this is this is basically how we do our analysis, which starts from the generation or use of atlases for the different species, the registration, segmentation, and ultimately generation of image and data in either two-dimensional or three-dimensional form. So the question obviously is, you know, how can you take an animal fully awake, put it in the bore of this magnet with all this noise, and expect it to behave like a normal rat? Well, a lot of work's been done to show that over the course of acclimating an animal, and that's very important. Before we do any studies, we acclimate animals to the restraint, to the sounds and sights of an MR scan. So these same pulse sequences are recorded, and we subject these to the animals for a period of anywhere from 4 to 8 days prior to study. This is a study or work published back in 2005 by King et al., showing that over the course of 5 days, physiology and stress levels in the form of catecholamine hormones come back towards baseline values within 5 days. Here's another study or data from that same study that showed that cerebral blood flow does not change and is not affected, of course, because of the autoregulation that the brain has. So looking at different areas within the brain compared to acclimated or not acclimated, there are no difference. However, importantly, what you can show is a better signal to noise or higher quality image in animals that have been acclimated, and this is again focused on specific regions within the brain. Last, this is a more recent study published by Marcelo Fabo, formerly of Northeastern, now in Florida, that showed over the course of acclimation, ultrasonic distress signals from the animal recorded over the course of 5 days of acclimation decrease. So these animals become more comfortable. I won't say they're completely at rest, but more comfortable than used to the acclimations and the MR scan. And just briefly, you can't see this that well, but you can trust me that you don't need to go to a radiology residency program to see that the difference between these high-resolution anatomical scans in an awake animal aren't really any different than ones that were anesthetized. The advantages, again, I like to think they're intuitive, but you know, certainly without having to anesthetize animals, you don't have the negative effects of anesthesia. And anybody working in the anesthesia field now is probably aware of an FDA initiative with industry called Smart Tots. Through all the retrospective analysis done, we now know that individuals subjected to prolonged periods and even shorter periods of anesthesia at critical times of development will have very severe developmental problems later in life. Women that are pregnant that go on to give birth, those children often 10 years down the road show significant developmental problems. We know anesthesia causes neuronal apoptosis and so on. So there are a lot of negative effects of anesthesia. You get a better bold signal in an awake animal as opposed to anesthesia, so your signal strength is better. What I think is very innovative and creative and cool are the provocation paradigms, as Kevin sort of touched upon, that you can use in an awake animal. We can present smells, sights, sounds, different stimuli to an awake animal, not possible in anesthetized animals. And obviously an awake image complements better the behavioral studies in animals, which of course are done while they're awake. The setup, as I described, is simple. It's more translational. And I put S7A for developmental people out there. You know that those are the regulatory guidelines for safety pharmacology. Back in the day, when I was first doing this stuff, when you used to do a cardiovascular safety study, you used to anesthetize a dog or an animal and put catheters through it and study cardiovascular profile following administration of a drug. Well, now, nobody would do that, really. You'd study the cardiovascular effects, whether it's QT prolongation or effects on heart rate and blood pressure, in a completely awake animal using telemetry. And that's what the regs basically mandate. I'd like to see, or like to think someday, we're going to move in the same way, both for imaging just for brain function, but potentially with its application for safety. On the disadvantage side, obviously there is motion in an awake animal, and we can correct to varying degrees for that. There's the need for physical restraint. So obviously, while stress can be minimized, there probably still is some to varying levels of stress. And really, it's an adoption thing in my mind. There are certainly a number of major pharmaceutical companies doing awake imaging. The company formerly known as Abbott, or AbbVie, does a lot of awake work. Merck does, BMS does, Eisai does. And the beauty of that is they all use the same systems. We all use the same systems. So there's a real advantage in that, too. I'm going to skip. Where are we?
You still
got
15 minutes?
No, okay. Give me five. So let me show you a quick example of what I think is the power of imaging an awake animal. These images on the left are just colored schematics of different neural networks, the olfactory system, the mesocortical limbic dopaminergic system. These images here are activation maps, if you will, three-dimensional, showing the areas in red being areas significantly active compared to baseline. And they represent the average of about 10 animals in these groups. So here's one group. So picture a male rat in the magnet restrained with a mate right in front of it. By mate, I mean a female mate. Okay, and what we're going to do is introduce a male intruder into the situation. Now, the male being imaged is not going to like that. So what we're imaging, or what we're looking for here, is aggressive motivation. And here's the response in untreated animals. Now, if you treat those animals with, this is a V1A antagonist, or fluoxetine or Prozac, you can do a very nice job in decreasing the amount of activation associated with this aggressive motive, aggressive motivation behavior. You can, you know, switch that around, and instead of putting an intruder in there, put a receptive female in front of the animal, and while treating those same groups with the same drugs, look for sexual motivation. And as everybody knows, one of the side effects of Prozac is a decrease in libido. Here you see those animals treated with fluoxetine or Prozac show very little in response to that receptive female, whereas the animals treated with this drug working through a different mechanism leave that mechanism or leave the response to that sexual motivation more in check or more intact. We do a lot of work in what's called PHMRI or pharmacological MRI. This is a pretty extensive and exquisite study of looking at the dose response of ketamine. And again, for anybody working in psychiatric or mental illnesses, know that there's a lot of work being done using ketamine now, both as a model of schizophrenia, but to treat also. This basically is a dose response for ketamine in awake animals. And again, looking at just one area in particular, the anterior cingulate, showing the increase in activation by the number of voxels that are being activated. And last, here's the representation of that same data, both two-dimensionally, showing the colored pixelation here, yellow and red is areas of significant activation over baseline, and as Craig refers to it, the eye candy three-dimensionally. I'll just, you know, leave you then with my summary. Suggest that awake animal imaging combined with the ability to do segmented atlas or use a segmented atlas is computational analysis has the potential to provide valuable and importantly translational information. And I think it adds to a lot of what was discussed earlier today on the toolbox that, you know, and really can provide a real benefit, especially to CNS-based drug discovery and development. And I'll paraphrase, you know, something Peter told me when he and I had lunch, that even a person with Parkinson's disease looks normal when they're sleeping. So, again, sort of, I don't remember where I got this quote, but the best, you know, I thought it was appropriate, and the best way to create value in the 21st century is to connect connectivity with technology. And it reminds me of a press release I saw from Charles River where Mike was quoted, and he refers to the old way of doing things as insane. So we all know the definition of insanity is doing the same thing over and over again and expecting a different outcome. Well, we can't develop drugs like we used to back in the 70s and 80s, and I'd like to think that with the advent or the development of the technologies like we heard about this morning in awake animal imaging, we're able to provide a better and more comprehensive toolbox for the industry that ultimately will allow us to bring better and more effective drugs to the patients that need them. Questions, lunch.
It sounds very challenging to do this in awake animals. And I was thinking, using a lot also for pharmacoFMRI, some of the drugs like ketamine will have very pronounced motor effects. So I'm kind of curious if your variability is in the noise ratio increases or the attrition of animals you cannot use because you have too much motion.
I guess I'm a little taken by your question, Rudy, at first, because ketamine, as we all know, is a pre-anesthetic. I mean, and typically, you know, interesting, there's a paper that Abbott published a few years ago where they used 30 milligrams of ketamine, which in our hands is a sedative. It puts the animals to sleep. So I can't remember, Craig, I don't know, we didn't have problems with excessive motion with ketamine. If anything, it would be just the opposite, certainly at the higher doses. But no, it was nothing out of the ordinary. Every once in a while, we do typically groups of 10. We'll have to discard a couple animals because of excessive motion that can't be corrected for. Oh, okay. We haven't used ketamine. We've used PCP, and we've done that in the monkey, actually. So I don't have any firsthand experience that I can relate to as far as ketamine as, you know, a drug used to induce the disease to see whether or not it can be prevented or influenced.
Is there anything, any logistics?